My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking racism at universities, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and a new journal of controversial ideas. It's all coming up.
Wider world is looking at this more. All of the reports in we've seen recently from schools, universities, the workplace, and you know, it's probably time to start really getting serious about this. I mean, from the moment that the student movement has been talking about this for probably the last 15 to 20 years, and certainly we will.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and here to help us wallpaper the walls of policy this week are three brilliant guests as usual. In Manchester, it's Ben Ward, CEO of Manchester Students' Union. Ben, your hire to the week, please.
Well, it's work-related. So yesterday, for the first time, I think, since I've been in post, we got all of the Russell Group Students' Union chief execs together to say we should probably do some stuff and start to work together. You know, the rampant rise of the mission groups, I think, needs a strategic Students' Union response, and that was really energising.
Didn't there used to be one? The Aldrich Group, wasn't that?
There did. So that's looking to be reformed as well for student officers, which I think is a really positive move.
And in Cumbria, we have Eunice Simmons, Vice-Chancellor of University of Chester. Eunice, your highlight of the week, please.
So my highlight over the past week has been watching spring really return. It's been great to see and hear lapwings returning from winter quarters, swallows jostling for position on telephone wires outside the house. Actually, lots of bees and butterflies, early emergers such as orange tips, small tortoiseshells, etc. So despite all those hard frosts, spring's finally arrived.
It has indeed. And in London, Debbie McVitie, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week.
Hiya. My highlight of the week has definitely got to be the Wonky at Home event that we ran yesterday, which was a micro commission on the future of learning resources. And we brought, our speakers really brought a lot of considered reflection and sanity and constructiveness to what's become a very heated debate. So it definitely gives me hope for finding a way forward.
Now, we start the week with the topic of racism at universities. And this week, BBC Three aired a documentary called Is Uni Racist? In which we heard from the Vice-Chancellor of University of East Anglia, Dave Richardson. Here's a clip.
The uni's processes have had a huge toll on the mental health of some students. And after going through the complaint system, it seems like students aren't being told of the outcome. I want to see what the unis have to say about this. Universities UK represent 140 universities across the country, including the ones featured so far. Last year, they established a group on racial harassment, and I'm meeting the UEA Vice-Chancellor, Professor David Richardson, who leads the group.
What do you think is the experience of black and sort of other ethnic minority students in the UK at university?
There's mixed experiences, but many aren't good. There's a lot of evidence that points towards universities perpetuating systemic racism, being institutionally racist. And I actually have acknowledged that on behalf of the sector.
Sorry, can I just, are you saying that universities are institutionally racist?
Yes.
You're saying that they're racist?
Yes.
Okay, that's huge.
Institutional racism is when there are systemic issues that are impacting disproportionately on particular members of your community,
right,
which need to be dismantled. And it's clear that there are.
What do you think about the complaints process at universities when it comes to reporting racial harassment?
I think that the reporting of racial harassment in universities is underreported.
Mm.
I think that historically, students who have experienced racial harassment have not felt able to report it or felt safe to report it for various reasons.
There is a view that universities are sort of downplaying the level of racism at institutions across the country. Do you get that? Is there any truth in that at all?
I understand where the view comes from. I'm not playing it down in the slightest. Perhaps governing bodies were concerned about the reputational impact of the university being seen to be a place that was, institutionally racist. And I think 5 years ago, people, leaders, universities would not have called this problem out.
Lots of students are telling me that their universities won't let them know the outcome of their complaints. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's really strange. Like, is there any truth in that? Why is that?
There will be truth in that. There are issues around every individual's right for data protection, and you need to be very careful about disclosure of outcomes. I've chaired two meetings to actually develop guidance for the sector that keeps us the right side of the law.
What I've heard is that they feel like it might impact their grades, their course, their career after uni.
That's disappointing. If that's how the students feel, then we need to acknowledge that and put in place better support to make them feel safe and to help them be reassured that this will not damage their grades at all.
David's group published guidance and recommendations for unis in November last year, and he's confident this will improve the experience of Black and ethnic minority students.
Summer 2022 is when we're going to do the full evaluation, and we do need to give it some time for universities to put this into their infrastructure.
Yeah, so I need to sort of check back in with you in a year's time.
You do, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I really will. I'd be keen to find out. Yeah. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you.
In one sense, I was kind of impressed with him, but I came back to my senses almost, and I was just like, but I've heard this before. And I guess the question is this going to be different from all the other times that we've heard this before?
Eunice, there's a lot to unpack here. What stood out from the documentary for you?
Yes, well, it was good to see a Nottingham Trent journalist, Linda Hadday, presenting this Perfect Storm programme. She really covered some important grounds in different universities across the country, basically by listening to students sharing some pretty awful experiences. So racial profiling, abusive language, racist student drama. But actually, what really stood out, and I think what we should focus on, is the theme of reporting of racial harassment and what happens then to the people who report it, at least what do they get told about it, and how are they dealt with as the process goes forward? Because there was a recurring theme about university processes almost versus the complainant, which I think came through strongly.
Yes, Debbie, I mean, one of the takeaways is from this whole thing clearly is about how processes applied and people feeling kind of disempowered by this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, your heart enormously goes out to these students because, of course, they just don't have the same sight of why the processes are the way they are as universities do. And it's and what struck me, I think, was, and it's clear that in some cases, you know, the processes had been run in a quite a sort of, you know, an inhuman way, which sort of tends to be the nature of process. But I think there's also something about formal processes that just can be, you know, quite disempowering. And I think it speaks to universities exploring what might happen, to support students in the first instance who have had these kinds of experiences and offer them a kind of a person, a name, you know, a human being with a face that they can talk to and kind of process that experience and think about what it is they want to do about it and what they want. And also what actions might be taken short of a formal complaint. If a student, you know, wants to go through that process and is committed to that and has the support in place, they should absolutely be entitled to do so. But it struck me that one of the kind of really unfortunate consequences of taking it to that point was that student then brought down upon, you know, it was, you know, incidences that perhaps in some cases could have been resolved with an apology, you know, that was all the student wanted, were then sort of escalated into this kind of enormous thing where the student themselves then became at the center of a row about race and then became subject to even more abuse than the kind of incident that they'd first experienced, you know, creating in some cases kind of, you know, serious mental health issues and need to drop out. And you just think, you know, the fact that it was able to get to that point in these cases suggests that there needs to be much more attention paid to that kind of immediate point of the aftermath, the support that's put in place and how that student is enabled and empowered to kind of get what they want from the process.
I guess we're also a year on from the Black Lives Matter movement really, really coming to public consciousness. Ben, I'm interested to get your sense of what's changed at university really since that rocketed up the agenda.
Well, I think change would probably be putting it strongly. I think what's happened is a renewed impetus and renewed focus to develop meaningful strategies, but more than anything, meaningful engagement. So, you know, I was, you know, interested to hear you talk about listening to students. And I think universities are realizing that it has to be a victim-centered approach and putting that package of support around whether it's racial harassment, sexual harassment, you know, a renewed focus on putting the students at the center of change. Certainly, student unions have been working closely for years with university leadership to drive EDI strategy, to put things on the agenda and keep them on the agenda so these things don't get forgotten. I think it's too early to say whether there's been any meaningful change. I read in a recent wonky blog around the recent Universities UK report making very similar recommendations to a Leadership Foundation report almost 10 years ago. So I think we'll wait and see whether meaningful change happens.
Mark, I wonder if I could come in here, because I absolutely agree that these are hurtful experiences. The quickest way to address the hurt fully is to enable the student to have sufficient trust to feel they can safely discuss it with their university, and also then to be kept informed of what action follows. So I think that the complainant needs to see evidence that there's been an improvement in university systems in a way, not just that they've been followed. I mean, it was very telling when one contributor said, you know, people will continue to make dark and dangerous jokes. And the student was called out, you know, for inappropriate behaviour. They were castigated for it by other students. So neither that nor the original incident were dealt with sufficiently carefully, I think.
There is this, I mean, and I wrote about this earlier in the week for the site, there is this kind of wider political backlash, I suppose, against this idea of institutional racism. And I can see that when David Richardson said it in November on Wonky, you know, sort of said, you know, yes, this is institutional racism and we're thinking about it that way as a sector, and that's how we're going to tackle it as a sector. You know, that felt like a really quite a big step, and, you know, and a really important step for the sector to come to terms with. And now, of course, we've got sort of politicians and saying, you know, oh, well, we think this idea of institutional racism is overplayed, and we're very nervous about the idea of kind of theories that sort of position people of color in a kind of victim, enforce a victim mentality. But of course, that's not what this analysis is doing. It's very much saying, how do we bring everyone together? Look at the way we do things, and look at the outcomes, and really, really make change. And that's, you know, so it is really kind of great that, I guess, universities are not running scared of the sort of wider cultural backlash against this idea.
Absolutely not. I mean, to be quite honest, our students of colour are absolutely behind this and involved in it. You know, they're well behind it. They're actually in the front of it. And that's as it should be. Likewise, our staff. So it is really odd to say that there's an institution, any institution, university or otherwise, where things aren't even and fair, and yet we won't tackle it as an institution. That just doesn't make sense.
Right. Also this week, Michelle Donlan faced MPs at the Education Select Committee in the House of Commons, and that ended up as a row about anti-Semitism at universities. And Robert Halfon, in particular, the chair of the committee, had some very strong words.
Why is that not acceptable? Why would you not intervene to deal with this and tell Bristol, the vice chancellor, that enough is enough, and that we're not living in 1930s Germany, and that they should deal with this problem and make sure that Bristol University is not a hostile environment to Jewish students?
Yeah, so universities in this country are autonomous. It's important that they then do this investigation and assess, you know, what was said which was lawful, what was said that wasn't lawful. There's a higher education regulator as well, which is the Office for Students. I will await that report. I completely agree with you. Anti-Semitism has no place in our universities. And I find it completely abhorrent. We've even given money to the Union of Jewish Students to assist with ensuring that campuses can be a safe.
Have you discussed this issue with the Vice Chancellor of the University?
So on this, I am awaiting the conclusions of the review, after which I will indeed speak to the Vice Chancellor.
So just to understand, how do you and the government intend to give confidence to Jewish students that anti-Semitism is taken seriously in the wake of high profiles of anti-Semitism? There's others in other campuses, but this is a particularly high profile one, and pretty shocking and disappointing. How do you intend to give confidence to Jewish students that this is not acceptable, and that actually the government will take action?
So there's a number of things that we've been doing in this space. So we've been encouraging universities to sign up to the IHRA definition. We've now got 98 and others considering that. That, as I said before, the Secretary of State wrote to the OFS in February, where we asked them to do a scoping exercise of those that hadn't signed up, and to look at potentially asking universities to publicise their incidences, so it's much more transparent. So students who are young people who are looking to go to university will have a clearer picture of what those universities represent in terms of tolerance, etc. And in addition, like I said, we were also giving money to the Union of Jewish Students to ensure that we can encourage a much more supportive environment. I meet with a number of representatives in this area, and I agree with you, more work needs to be done. But on this specific example, we will wait for that review and see exactly what it concludes.
Will you then have conversations with the senior management at Bristol University?
Absolutely, yes.
I hesitate to separate anti-Semitism from this broader racism agenda. But there is a kind of particular set of issues, isn't there, about the experience of Jewish students, and this isn't going away. And I think the media has picked up on kind of a deficit area. I mean, Ben, I'm interested to know what the atmosphere is like at Manchester at the moment when it comes to this question.
Well, I mean, we are often at the forefront of this debate. You know, traditionally, high numbers of Jewish students at Manchester connected to local Jewish communities, but coupled with lots of activism on campus around the Israel-Palestine question. Now, you know, has there been as much conflict and activism as normal years outside of a pandemic? No. Is the issue bubbling under? Yes. One of the things that I think, you know, we have to do as an organisation is recognise anti-Semitism exists, support the definitions of anti-Semitism, undertake training for our officers and staff to recognise and call out where anti-Semitism exists. And we've got lots of learning to do, as we have for all forms of racism and discrimination.
Eunice, I'm interested to know where you've got to as a university at Chester, and particularly in the IHRA definition, which I know has been dominating a lot of discussion at governing bodies the last several months.
It has. Well, we've got a subcommittee of governing body called Mission Committee, and we have agreed through that, and we've signed the IHRA, obviously cognizant also of our legal obligations across, you know, the whole equality arena. But interesting, I went on a visit to Auschwitz a few years ago with some other VCs, my then VP Education, and the Union of Jewish Students. And on the one hand, it felt so wrong to actually be standing almost like a tourist on the site of such atrocities. On the other hand, it was a profound experience. I think it's given me much more of a radar to be alive to anti-Semitic undercurrents and actions.
I mean, what struck me, I think, as well about this select committee hearing was the MP suggesting that essentially that, you know, Michelle Donlan as universities minister should be picking up the phone to the vice chancellor at Bristol and kind of saying, well, why haven't you sacked this man yet? What are you doing? We want you know, reports of progress. And of course that. It's sort of it's evidence of the strength of feeling, I suppose, about the issue and the sort of the importance of universities being quite as transparent as they can be, given, you know, given the circumstances of being essentially a kind of, you know, an investigation into the conduct of a staff member about how they're handling these issues. It is interesting, isn't it, that MPs are under the impression that would be a reasonable thing for a university's minister to do, and I think it says something about kind of how politicised universities are becoming, and how much influence, you know, policymakers think they should have. You know,
I think that's right, but they also it indicates how they still, well, they're starting to view universities as really part of the school system, where they can reach in and take an action or shake it up.
But I think in the public we're probably wouldn't understand why not. It's sort of common sense. People would assume that ministers might have some say over what goes on at universities and their policies, I think.
I guess they would, although quite how they would manage, you know, hundreds of higher education institutions, as well as run the FE and do everything else, I'm not quite sure. I do think that the interventionist approach is not going to solve this. On the other hand, I do think that anti-Semitism is still very much with us. So I'm entirely sympathetic to the view that we just have to have our antennae out for it.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to hear what the regulator has to say about this. I get the impression that they're there's lots of things coming out of the Department for Education that maybe the regulator has.
I think also it speaks to, you know, it speaks to that difference between the kind of symbolic adoption of a position, and I think, you know, we're talking about institutional racism. You know, for David Richardson to stand up and say, yes, universities are institutionally racist is a brave thing to do. Likewise, to choose to adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is, you know, it takes a position. It puts you on, you know, on one side of a fence. And that is, I think, a really important thing for universities to do as kind of, you know, in their public and civic role, that, you know, but you really do need to back it up with action. And that is, you know, that is the most important thing.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Claire Taylor, Deputy Vice Chancellor and Professor of Education at Wrexham Glyndwr University. I've been thinking about asking questions, and my piece offers a provocation around moving away from functional questions that consider what, who, when, very much a focus of the past year, towards creating space for asking more powerful questions as we look to the future. And for me, it's the why questions that we need to be better at asking. Asking why moves away from the operational and transactional into the realms of inspiration and innovation. And in my view, we really need this as a sector as we move out of a period focused on COVID response. But in addition, in my piece, I also suggest we need to facilitate opportunities and space for new voices to ask why across the sector and within our own organisations. We need to be prepared to seek diversity of thought, listen to different voices, and step beyond our comfort zone. Someone once said, the future belongs to the curious. So let's have a go. Let's move away from asking what and when and move into the space that asks why.
Now, Hepi's out with a new report about students and sex, and there's research about student drug taking too. Ben, talk us through it.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the much mooted mass return to universities on the 17th of May is fast approaching. Two pieces of research came out this week. So HEPI published a report on its polling of around 1,000 students in partnership with YouthSight. And only a small minority of students felt well educated about sex and relationships prior to entering higher education. But the most interesting stat, and the one that's really hitting the headlines, is 58% of students agreeing with the proposal that students be required to pass sexual consent assessments before arriving at university. And, you know, we are, I suppose, back into this cycle of talking about consent classes. You know, every time we've tried to do it, the fury of certain elements of the press bears down on universities and student unions. And I'm talking from the Hidden Mark survey that NUS did all of those years ago, 10 years ago this year, right to now. And the second thing, from Students Organising for Sustainability, conducted a piece of research on drug use at university. Only 13% of students reported taking drugs, but their peers actually believe that 85% of students did. So a real mismatch between reality and perception.
Mm. Did either of these pieces of research ring true, though, for you, Eunice, and what you know about your students?
Well, certainly thinking about the drugs one, yes, because I think there's peer sort of both peer pressure to get involved in drugs, and that's highlighted in the research. But there's also a sort of a folklore about it, and I guess that's probably why you get this huge number that think everyone else is doing this, and actually they're not. So I'm still, you know, having seen the individual incidences that arise out of drug use and the tragedies, I'm still thinking 13% is too high, but at least it isn't 80.
Debbie, the press today picked up on the consent angle.
This is interesting, and I think, you know, there's some probably some things to kind of unpack here about the wording of the question and stuff. I mean, it's always, you know, but essentially this idea that something like 58% of students agreed that students should be required to pass a sexual consent assessment before, you know, essentially being allowed to go to university. And I think what this captures, and actually, on a sort of slightly more kind of benign, but still quite worrying finding, about 2/3 said that they were sort of comfortable with, that they understood and they'd been taught sufficiently about consent, and about 1/3 said that they really didn't feel that comfortable, and you know, that they were kind of across that, and that to me is the more worrying thing. And Jim wrote an excellent blog this morning for the site, and he draws out, I think, because I think there's a very it's a very reasonable case to make that university is not the best equipped organisation to teach students about sex and relationships. You know, you can absolutely make the argument to say this is an academic sphere, they're adults, you know, this is not our job to kind of, I guess, bring them up to speed. And, you know, and you can absolutely make that case. But I think there's also a case to be made, which Jim pulls out, which is saying that yes, except that if they don't know about this stuff and they're not comfortable with it, and that's getting them into, as a consequence, that's getting them into some difficult situations, which then kind of spiral out, that will actually affect their academic performance. You know, knowing and being comfortable with these issues is actually a precondition of being able to learn effectively. And therefore, universities need to kind of sort of accept that these are the students they have and kind of work with that. And it was also notable that about two thirds felt that some engagement with questions of sex and relationships and consent should be mandatory during the welcome week period, or the kind of, you know, the sort of transition period, I suppose we would call it. So I think a few things here. One is that this does rather go against the kind of media narrative about, you know, the student Stasi kind of, you know, spying in you know, people's bedrooms and that sort of thing. And this being, or indeed that, you know, having to, that there's something extremely demeaning about being told not to rape and what consent means, as if this is kind of self-evident. I think a lot of people actually don't find it self-evident, and it can be hard to wrap your head around it when you're talking about, you know, complex interactions between two individuals, often, you know, in the context of drugs and alcohol. You know, so there is a sense that kind of actually the wider student body might actually rather welcome the conversation. And then, of course, the other question is about sort of saying, how do you do this in a way that is supportive, that acknowledges the breadth of experience, that doesn't, I suppose, kind of introduce shame into the equation? Because, of course, you know, and you know, just under half of students have never actually had a sexual encounter of those polled when they come to university. So, you know, in some cases, you're actually talking about a world in which there is only actually limited direct experience. And that sort of, and these sorts of things need to be taken account of as well. We're not talking about a very kind of knowing group of young people. Actually, in lots of cases, we're talking about some potentially rather innocent people. So yeah, so I think it's a bit of a head scratcher how you tackle this stuff, particularly when there's a lot else to cover in those early weeks.
There is, Debbie, but I think this is a really helpful report, really helpful, because it does, as you've outlined, it does describe that the students are, you know, very different in terms of their experience when they arrive at uni. But we do facilitate a lot of socialising, let's face it, both the university and the student union. That's what, you know, we do want the students to make a friendship group. We do want them to settle, you know, and have a very good time. So it's all part and parcel of that, especially if the students are younger. So I think it's part of our responsibility. And what I think we're missing here is the respect word, because, you know, the respect and consent, they go together. So the consent piece really helps build a culture of mutual respect amongst peers, and also between students and staff. Don't forget, that's also a factor. So I found this massively useful, because it's a great way to have the conversation now with students. It's actually given us a few more things to actually focus on. And I think even pre-induction material, we'll be putting in even more than we have. We'll be building on this and actually using this report. I think it's very helpful.
I mean, Ben, again, sort of similar question before. What's changed this year?
Well, I suppose what's interesting is the lack of that social interaction that people are having, that opportunity to form and develop friendship groups that give them that sense of belonging. Often students feeling very isolated. But I also think, you know, the wider world is looking at this more. All of the reports in we've seen recently from schools, universities, the workplace, and, you know, it's probably time to start really getting serious about this. I mean, from the moment that that, you know, the student movement has been talking about this for probably the last 15 to 20 years, and certainly we launched a big campaign in 2013 called We Get It, which was looking at making our campus safe and free of sexual harassment. Now, that was very surface level at the time, but we've started to go deeper. The, you know, the university has recruited and appointed a sexual violence response team that takes this very seriously, to start developing survivor-led approaches. And, you know, again, like the racism and discrimination work that we talked about before, putting students at the centre of change has to be the best way of looking at this.
I think that's right. I think Eunice's point about respect is a really interesting one, because of course you can be respectful to someone, you can treat them well as a human being, you can learn how to be kind of attentive to their needs without ever having sex with them. You know, it might never enter the sexual realm. And the more that those sorts of behaviors and cultures are established, and the more people are given, I guess, you know, language to challenge when people are being disrespectful, the more you change the culture that otherwise would allow incidents of misconduct and harassment and violence to sort of not only to flourish but to go unchecked and to kind of have the sort of veil of kind of complexity and shame arise up around them. So yes, I think that's very true.
And now it's time for the hidden history of higher education with Mike Ratcliffe.
So records do show sometimes the depth of policy interaction between government and higher education. One of those opportunities is when vice-chancellors go to see the Prime Minister. Now in the late 60s, vice-chancellors were summoned in to see the Prime Minister because their students were so revolting that the Prime Minister had to share secret intelligence with them from the security services about the behaviour and get them to behave themselves. Sadly, I couldn't find the notes of that meeting, but I did find the notes of the meeting that Ted Heath had with a group of vice-chancellors in 1973. And he'd widened the group, so not only did he see vice-chancellors, he saw directors of polytechnics as well, because they'd come into being and Margaret Thatcher had not killed them off in her white paper, and so they were going strong. And the file is lovely because it contains the briefing notes for the ministers in advance of the setup, and it contains the record of what happened at the meeting. So the briefing notes are cheery because they set out for the Prime Minister what's going on. The vice-chancellors are concerned that the government doesn't love them, doesn't consider them relevant enough. So says the briefing note. However, the polytechnics are in good heart. They have their preoccupations. They want to have the clarification of their role with the local authority sorted out, and that they're going to be quite happy with the massive expansion, trebling, of their student numbers following the white paper. They're up for this, the polytechnic directors. There aren't many notes on the polytechnic directors, but there's this great section whereby each of the vice-chancellors has a little note given to Ted Heath to explain who they are and what kind of character they have. So it sets out in some detail. So Alan Bullock, who's the vice-chancellor of Oxford at the time, is a distinguished modern historian, in manner very much the Oxford Yorkshireman, plain-spoken, witty and humane. The first four-year Oxford vice-chancellor with a year to serve. Dr. Morrison of Bristol is described as one of the younger vice-chancellors, 48, vigorous and open-minded as well as very intelligent. Professor Armitage of Manchester is a very resourceful man with an excellent judgment which he chooses to conceal under a bumbling manner. The notes go on explaining what Ted can expect from each of the vice-chancellors in front of him. And clearly the evening goes well, they have a discussion, and it focuses on the key issue of whether universities should be providing thinkers or doers. And the representatives of the polytechnics argue that the major mistake made by universities was to value knowledge for the sake of knowledge. The great majority of graduates pursue their careers in the world of action, not of reflection. And this basic fact should be reflected in university entrance requirements and in final examinations. We're still waiting for that. At present, the university's approach was too scholastic. So they set themselves up in opposition. They are the relevant institutions providing people with a way into work. And Ted Heath sums up, and there's a note picking up, that Heath is critical of the universities who too often fail to teach their students to think straight, to recognise quality, and without a thorough training in the basic intellectual processes the next generation would need to find themselves to compete. And here's a great example of why we need that. To argue the British case successfully in, for example, Paris or Brussels, would call for the higher standards of intellect and ability. At the same time, the education system had a major part in creating a more flexible social structure in the country so that ability, wherever it might be found, could be developed and exploited to the full. Heath wants universities to help us in our new mission to be in Europe. Not sure how that's going to turn out, but there we go. That's what universities should really help to do. So Heath, of course, doesn't last long, but Margaret Thatcher is the Secretary of State, and she's there, and she listens to all of this and obviously participates in the discussion. And when she gets into power, you can see that distinction between the universities and their too academic, and the polytechnics who are keen to do the work that the government wants to do. And eventually that wins them their freedom at the end of the binary line.
Thank you. WonkFest, our Festival of Higher Education, returns in June. And because of the year we've all just had, we're using it as an opportunity to look ahead. What worked? What didn't? And how can we come back stronger as universities, professionals, and as a sector? And crucially, how can higher education drive the global recovery? It's all about how we build back higher. We'll hear from people who've been at the heart of the government response, like National Statistician Ian Diamond, Vice Chancellors, Students' Union Officers, and literally, and I mean literally, everything and everyone in between. It's online only this year, well, because you know why. But we're working hard to keep the best of the WonkFest, you know, bustling with insights you can take back to your institutions at the end, and Team Wonky will be on hand every step of the way to help guide you through it. It's all happening on 9th and 10th of June. The programme is out now and you can find out more and book your tickets at wonkfest.co.uk. And as usual, group discounts and plus and partner rates apply. We look forward to seeing you in June to help us build back higher together. Now, Debbie, there's a new journal of controversial ideas. What on earth is going on?
So this is an idea that was established in 2018 by a group of philosophers. And if you're a philosophy person, you'll know these names: Francesca Minerva, Jeff McMahon, and Peter Singer. I took a few philosophy modules back in the day, and I remember reading Peter Singer. And the idea is that this journal, it's open access. This is a space where ideas that the authors might otherwise struggle to air in conventional academic outputs, either because the editors were kind of found those ideas distasteful, they were kind of outside of the common run and they weren't sort of seen to be credible, or because they were thought to be too controversial and the fear was that they would generate kind of too much heat and kind of controversy for the mainstream journals. So this is a space where these ideas can be published and discussed. The driving force here is kind of freedom of speech, and of course it gets a lot of attention because of all the concerns about sort of wokeness on campus and the thought police and freedom of speech and academic freedom. My colleague David Kernan helpfully went and read in every article in the first issue and was sort of entertainingly scathing about it on the site, and then commend that article to readers. I think the point I would make, I tend to try to not be cynical, and I confess to not having read every piece. I think the thing to say about this journal is that it's a journal of philosophy. I can't really speak, I'm not a philosopher, I can't speak to the kind of quality of the academic rigor of the papers presented here. But I think the articles have a lot of features of philosophical debate, in that they are essentially extracting ideas from their context and trying to look at them very purely through particular kinds of theoretical lenses. So, for example, an article about essentially advocates for the value of silly ideas being allowed to be advocated on campuses. And it sort of says, look, we're not going to look at questions about trans rights, we're not going to look at questions about race and racial harassment, but we are going to look at this idea of flat earth. And this is a very useful kind of philosophical tool to explore the value to the production of knowledge of debating silly ideas. And the case is quite credible, in that if you had someone, by engaging with a kind of bad argument, you might understand a good argument, and that there might be kind of merit in that from a sort of epistemological viewpoint. The problem is, of course, that when people are wrestling with these controversial ideas, they're not doing it in a vacuum. They're not doing it devoid of political context or people who might be hurt or harmed by the consequences of decisions. And that's why I think, I think there's merit in saying let's debate controversial ideas, and I think particularly when people feel strongly about it, it's just you can't really make those decisions in a philosophical vacuum where everyone's a kind of rational actor and it's all very kind of neutralized.
Mm. Is it a legitimate reason to set up? Is it a legitimate journal? I mean, Eunice, you're a scientist. Can you set up a journal for things that you want to say, even if you want to use it to promote your racist ideology? Is that just because you call it a journal, does it make it a journal?
I think that the sector will decide on whether or not it gets any credibility. It sounds a bit tautological, but it's a contrarian journal in some respects, appearing to be contrary for its own sake. And Debbie's point about which other arguments it puts adjacent to, which arguments does it put adjacent to create that controversy and that contrarianness, is very telling. So I think as long as it's approached with that caution, it's almost the format is as important as some of the ideas that are in it. The format of each, how each of those articles is constructed and what's in and what's out is really interesting.
Yeah, I suppose one thing that interested me is just that the hyperbole around this, you know, comparing themselves to Socrates and Galileo, who often found it difficult to express their views at a time of intolerance. Now, I'm not sure any of these ideas have been stopped or had any trouble being published anywhere on the internet or on university campuses. And this false hyperbole that's created as if this is a bastion of strength against something that doesn't really exist. And you know, these are things that we're wrestling with on a daily basis. I mean, there was a briefing at our university senate yesterday around freedom of speech, and one of the things that we reflected is that in the last 5 years alone, we've had nearly 3,000 external speakers of every stripe, every political stripe, and I think we've stopped one from speaking for safety reasons, and so. You know, this is going on in universities. I really loved a comment on the site this morning that someone said that perhaps Wonky should launch a journal of kitchen conversations at 3 a.m. after a night at the SU. Yeah. Which is exactly what a lot of this reads like. Absolutely, and I'd certainly subscribe to that journal.
I think my favorite example being ultimate meaning. We don't have it. We can't get it, and we should be very, very sad. In which the paper argues that there is no meaning to life, which is hardly new or controversial, or contrarian. I guess the point is that, you know, this person's sad about that and is looking for validation.
Well, I mean, in an era of positive psychology where there's all, you know, there is, I mean, Barbara Ehrenreich has written a really interesting book about the kind of, the sort of social pressure to be happy. But I suppose this is the point, isn't it? This is not a contrarian idea. This is fairly, you know, this is very much on the spectrum of kind of ideas that are in circulation already.
I agree with that, but I suggest that don't dip in if you do need clarification or if you feel depressed to start with. It's not a mood improver.
Yes.
No. But it's also quite circular. I think, you know, there's no meaning to all of our human endeavours, apparently. I mean, I guess that includes this journal.
I think it's a question of bandwidth as well, isn't it? As, you know, if you're an academic philosopher who happens to take an interest in ideas at the margin as a kind of social phenomenon, you know, this absolutely might be your bag, and I think you can legitimately engage with that as an academic pursuit. But if you're going to do that, you've got to be very, very thoughtful and go in with positive intentions. And I think there is some evidence of this here of that here too. But it's just not clear to me that this is something that people who aren't that person should engage with or spend their time thinking about. And I certainly don't think it gives lay people, you know, not, you know, you know, who are kind of facing some of these really challenging issues in their professional and daily lives. I don't really think it gives them the tools to handle that.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thanks to Eunice, Debbie, Ben and Mike Ratcliffe and everyone else at Team Wonky that helps to make it happen behind the scene. Until next week, stay safe, stay wonky.